We are back. Dr. Tony Hale, let me ask you about global warming. What is your basic take on this question of whether the Earth's climate is rising in temperature over the past whatever?
Well, if you'll pardon the pun, global warming's been a hot topic for quite a while now. And it's kind of my contention that the worldview that you bring into the discussion about global warming will strongly bias how you ultimately feel whether global warming is a significant issue or whether it's an insignificant issue. So there's all sorts of approaches that one can tackle this very difficult and complex problem with. And I thought maybe we would flesh out some of the fundamentals of what scientists think on the matter and try to get out what everyone agrees upon, and then try to see where people diverge and maybe make up our minds along the way as to whether it's a significant issue or not.
And we're going to do all that in the next 18 minutes.
Yes, exactly. Although, you know, I taught a college course at Sac State on air quality and air pollution, and I think the global warming took about a week, so we're going to have to speak rather quickly.
Let me ask you this. In California, before the white man got here, there was burning was a common way of increasing the production of the oak forests all over the world. Aborigines in Australia, all over the world, burning was something that primitive man practiced. And yet, when we look at the issue of carbon dioxide increases in the atmosphere, we focus on industry and the burning of coal, the burning of oil, to basically turn the wheels of modern industrial technology. Isn't it possible that then there was an awful lot of CO2 being released over the millennia?
Well, I mean, there's always been sources and sinks of carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, in addition to methane and nitrous oxide and some other lesser chemicals, are all considered greenhouse gases. But the carbon cycling through forest fires, which naturally happen, has always been part of the natural cycle.
And lightning fires, of course, have been with us long before before man was on the planet.
It's just that, you know, the forests, if you burn those, it's not a significant reservoir of carbon. That carbon was once in the air, Now you're re-releasing it. When you burn fossil fuels, you're taking a rich supply of carbon that took millions of years to accumulate, right, and then you're releasing that, you know, very, very quickly. So it's out of the natural cycle.
I'm curious, when you say that, about how much carbon would can you estimate is locked up in the world's oil reserves and coal seams versus what is currently in the biosphere? Any idea?
I haven't a clue.
Yeah.
You know, you could take a global average of carbon dioxide and then multiply that by the volume of the atmosphere to come up with that number. But offhand, I don't know.
I saw an interesting stat, too, that if we burned all of the Earth's forests, it would basically not even dent the Earth's oxygen. It would increase our CO2 by a significant amount.
Yeah, a lot of people, they look at deforestation as an oxygen issue. It's not an oxygen issue. The atmosphere is 20% oxygen. There's plenty of that to go around. It's just whether you upset some of the other important species, the trace elements, you know, things that are less than 1%, including the greenhouse gases. That's the issue. We're not going to run out of oxygen.
Now, in preparation for this this program, we briefly talked about the fact that you looked up the number for me, that at the time of, I guess, the Industrial Revolution beginning, circa 1800, we had in the Earth's atmosphere about 250 parts per million.
Well, I see here at 1800, we have 280 parts per million.
Okay, 280 parts per million. The current number that we're at is 350.
Approximately, correct.
So we have increased in the past two centuries the amount of CO2, which is a very important gas. We've increased it by 1/4, which is a fairly significant bump.
It seems, there's natural variation of in all ambient chemicals, but this seems clearly one-sided, that it was the advent of the Industrial Revolution that we have this huge upswing of carbon dioxide.
And there seems to be no end in sight as we continue to burn more coal and more oil.
As a culture, our energy consumption is increasing, in addition to our population increasing. So,
and looking ahead to people like China, with its 1.2 billion people, looking to have a standard of living like the United States, or certainly better than they have now, they have tremendous energy needs. And where they're going to get the energy? Well, China's got lots of coal. They're going to be burning stuff to generate energy.
And you know, global warming, these long-term air quality studies, this is mostly the domain of international countries, like in Europe. In the United States, we focus our efforts much more on acute effects of pollutants. What is the ozone? How does it affect humans? Whereas in Europe, right, they're much more interested in climatological, you know, issues.
Well, there are an awful lot of issues, aren't there? Acid rain is one issue. Chlorinated fluorocarbons in the ozone hole, another issue. And the atmosphere is sort of being looked at a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, it's a complex system, and our tinkering and our effect on it may have significant impacts as to whether life, or human life, or, you know, mammal life is sustainable on the Earth. So it's garnished quite a bit of attention.
Let me get your opinion on the issue here, that there has been an increase in the Earth's temperature. There's a rather dramatic increase in the past decade, which I believe the last 10 years were the 10 warmest years ever recorded. Now, many people like to poo-poo this and say this is just, you know, this is just alarmist nonsense, that this is a very short-term trend. It's not very meaningful statistically. We've only had good weather numbers to deal with at all since we've had thermometers and you know, a system of measurements of various weather stations dating back a little over a century. So a lot of folks say this is bunk. How can you say that?
Well, in support of those people who say it's bunk, there's all sorts of things, like most of the temperature sensors are taken in urban environments, and so you have urban island effects because it's all concrete and pavement. So
which
maybe
tends to heat things more perhaps than it would in the country.
Up, right? Yeah. So maybe you're having a natural bias in Mark Twain time where they measured the temperature versus now. And there's ways using ice core data to try to determine what the temperature was in the past. I think
which I understand is quite accurate. You can go to Greenland, dig an ice core down, and measure the ratio of oxygen, one of the isotopes of oxygen 18, and tell from that the temperature of the atmosphere in which it was formed.
Well, the people who do that sort of research says it's very accurate, but that's kind of one of the nice things about having an untestable theory. You know, if you have no other outside way to measure it, then you say it's perfect correlation.
I believe they can correlate it to actual weather measurements, at least the last century.
It's a well-respected technique.
Yeah.
But as to whether 10 years or 100 years of temperature data makes a significant impact as to whether we can verify or not verify whether there's global warming happening, it's kind of incidental to the whole global warming argument. The global warming argument isn't based on a statistical, you know, let's look at the last 10 years, oh, it went up, because there's natural variation in the Earth's average temperature over regions. I think what's of more significance is if we look at the energy balance, if we look at the amount of solar radiation coming from the sun and hitting the Earth, if we're doing things that perturb where the amount of radiation or energy being absorbed by the Earth, then we are going to affect temperature. So if we just isolate the chemicals that we're looking at and see what their effect is, then in the absence of any data, we can intuit what is going to happen as a consequence. Yeah. So the whole global warming idea is basically that you have greenhouse gases, and these gases will allow energy from the sun to hit the Earth because they're in a short wave radiation. And then when this energy is re-released by the Earth in the form of infrared radiation, it will be absorbed by these gases.
So like in a greenhouse, the light gets in, but the heat doesn't get out.
Correct. Greenhouses typically work more on just stopping wind from taking away the
right,
heat.
Yeah,
much more so
than the actual, what we call the greenhouse effect.
Right, yeah, the whole, you know, color and transmissivity of the greenhouse material is incidental to the fact that, you know,
greenhouses get warm.
Yeah, they keep the wind out, right? But is when you're talking about the Earth, we have a couple greenhouse gases, including methane, which is a complex hydrocarbon. And we also have carbon dioxide and water vapor and nitrous oxide. So we can take a look at, well, what happens if we increase carbon dioxide? Essentially, what we're doing is we're going to increase the Earth's ability to trap energy, and in return, this will be a temperature increase.
Right.
In a sense, we can think of it as, if you're lying on a bed and you have a sheet and a blanket to keep you warm, if you add a sheet or if you add a blanket to your bed, maybe one sheet a year, you can say in the absence of qualitative descriptions as to whether you were comfortable last night or whether you thought it was hot or cold, you know that eventually adding, you know, 100 sheets over the next 100 years will have an effect of you at the bottom of this pile of sheets as to whether it's hot or cold. Right. And there might be all sorts of other things going on, but if you isolate just that one aspect, you can make some pretty clear-cut descriptions as to what's going to happen. Yeah. And so the environmental approach or people who consider greenhouse gases to be a concern, they typically say, well, forget all that nonsense about all this outlying data or whether this is or is not representative of world cycles. We have a problem. We're adding sheets. We're adding all this carbon into the atmosphere. And it's going to eventually be a problem. And we don't know what's going to happen. So let's not do it.
It seems as though the Europeans are certainly going into this whole hog while our administration is basically dragging its feet. I know a lot of people that are just plain old skeptical about this whole idea. They say that, you know, well, how can you base this on such a limited amount of data? But all around the world, there seems to be a great convergence. We had Michael Shermer, the editor of the Skeptic magazine, when it made an appearance in the show last year. He's basically looking at it and saying the people that are denying this seem to be the same small group of people, that by and large, studies all over the world seem to be accumulating a massive evidence suggesting that glaciers, for example, on Mount Kilimanjaro and tropical equatorial mountains are just plain disappearing. Iceland is losing its ice cover. More and more large icebergs are calving off of the, you know, the Ross Ice Shelf and I guess areas like that down in Antarctica. So it seems clear that the weather measurements being taken all over the world are actually reflecting a clear trend toward warming of the Earth.
Well, it's always a good idea if someone's giving you advice to see whether they have something to gain from that advice, right? So not to say that environmentalists are disinterested parties. They definitely have an agenda. But if someone stands to make $1 billion of a year based on saying, hey, I think everything's great, and someone else is just saying, in the absence of any profit motive, they're saying, that's not such a good idea, you can weigh into how heavily they might have a personal gain associated with it.
Anyone who's familiar with the pronouncements that came out of the American Tobacco Institute, every time they'd say, well, we've got a study that shows that this is, you know, smoking may be bad, they would then, in the interest of, quote, fairness, unquote, quote somebody from the American Tobacco Institute saying, well, we think that's a poorly done study. Our study showed that smoking's just fine, thanks.
Well, yeah, that's a great point. You think of how hard it is to get money for environmental purposes. You have to go through writing grants. It's very expensive in terms of you know, trying to get people to study things. It's a long process. And think of the resources that energy company command. I mean, like millions of dollars is nothing for their research budget. Millions of dollars per day is nothing for their... And there have not been a flood of journal articles or scientific studies that say it's not a problem, even with all those resources, even with all they have to gain by showing that it isn't a problem. A consortium of international scientists routinely come up with saying it's a concern, it's something to worry about.
So I think the basic thrust of all this would be to say that adding all of the CO2 to the atmosphere is probably something we shouldn't be doing as we have been.
Well, the counterargument would be, well, we don't really know what's happening. There's all sorts of competing effects.
Maybe and there's also efforts to remedy this by basically putting phytoplankton out in the ocean that would absorb all of the CO2.
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, you drop these lunatic scheme to put iron, I guess, which is the ingredient they're missing, and basically turn huge areas of the ocean green. In essence, farming the ocean with plants to then have them absorb it. It's a bit of a wacky idea, but people are talking about this kind of thing.
I have seen articles where they talk about the dangers of having nutrient or limited species like phytoplankton in the remote ocean, that they're getting excess iron from urban centers, and so they don't know what's going to happen to the phytoplankton populations out in the remote ocean. I haven't heard of using this scheme to counterbalance.
I've been hearing this for many a year.
That seems like a really good idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly too, in the wake, one of the few good things that come out of the 9/11 attacks was the fact that atmospheric scientists such as yourself were able to look at satellite photos and observe that there was an absence of contrails. Jets, and there's, you know, God knows the number of jets in the air at any given moment, are not putting out these clouds of, you know, of water behind them. And they noticed there was an actual significant increase in temperature because the contrails were not reflecting all of that light, which I thought was very interesting.
I haven't heard that. That's definitely under the, if you were a skeptic, you would say, well, natural variations, that's just the way it goes. Are we really going to jeopardize billions of dollars, our whole economy? Are we going to put people out of work just on, you know, the fact that you can't see contrails? That would be their counter-argument.
Right. Much again, I hate to keep sounding like a broken record, but much as the tobacco companies argue that if you can't really prove that you're going to drop dead by smoking that pack of Luckies, then, you know, well, shoot, why don't you just go ahead, puff away.
Profit motive is a very powerful motive.
Yes, they are.
Another interesting point about air quality is typically one thinks of the Republican Party as being pro-business, anti-environment, and the Democrats as being more pro-environment. But if you look at some of the major legislation and trends, it's a little confusing as to which party is truly an environmental party. If you look at when Earth Day started, when the EPA was founded, and when the Clean Air Act passed, it was in 1970. So Doug's a trivia buff. Who was the president at that time?
Richard M. Nixon.
Nixon. And Nixon was about as Republican as you can get. Mm-hmm. If you look at the next major air quality legislation, it was in 1990, the Clean Air Act revisions, which gave significant teeth economically and penalty-wise to the original Clean Air Act. And so who was president back then?
George H.W. Bush.
Obviously another Republican.
But isn't that often an effort to get something on paper before your opponents get something that you're going to like even less?
Yes and no. The whole Clean Air Act revisions were basically flip-flopping and without purpose for about a decade. Uh-huh. Now, obviously, Reagan tried to dismantle EPA and was pretty effective. I'm not suggesting that
Republicans are actually environmentally friendly. But
when the Democrats claim to be the environmental party, it has to be taken with a grain of salt.
On that very note, I have to ask you, when George Bush the first was king, we...
I didn't vote for the king. The true success story of air quality has always been lead, getting lead out of gasoline, a one-step process. Get rid of it, it's no longer a problem. There is re-entrainment issues, but there hasn't been this sweeping reform where Americans use less sulfur fuel and that all of the air quality plants have perfect emission controls, although there are improvements there.
Well, Dr. Tony Hill, thank you once again for coming on and discussing this important issue. I want you to come back, if you will, and discuss the long-range history of the Earth in terms of these great, vast global temperature changes that we have some understanding of geologically, because I think that's a very interesting topic and has some bearing on the claims people make today and counterclaims about how can you say this, how can you say that.
I'd love to, and I'd just like to leave with the idea that if releasing hydrocarbons and fuel into the atmosphere could lead to massive worldwide climate change, then the conservative approach would be not to do something that could be dangerous. The risky approach would be say, it'll probably take care of itself. Let's not rock the boat. Mm-hmm. So the conservative approach is to make sure that you're not doing something that could be a problem.
Conservatives out there, take note. You're listening to KDVS on 90.3 FM.